After the war ended, the major women's amateur tournament schedule resumed, and Babe was ready. She won the Women's Texas Open in the fall of 1945. She also defeated one of golf's new glamour girls, Betty Jamison, a 26-year-old former feature reporter from San Antonio, in a 72-hole challenge match. Babe and Betty ran into each other in the near-empty locker room at the Los Angeles Country Club less than an hour before their match. It was their first meeting. "My, but you're a big girl," Babe said. "So, you ready to finish second?" On the course, they were followed by an enormous, boisterous gallery, including film star Gary Cooper. Jamison did finish second, and she never forgot Babe's supreme confidence. "I thought I was pretty confident, and I also thought I was the best there was," she recalled, "but I had nothing on the Babe." Early one evening in November 1945, Babe picked up the phone in the living room of her Denver home and called Peggy Kirk. It was the first time the two had spoken since the evening they had spent together in Indianapolis 5 months earlier, after Babe's mother's death. Babe asked if Kirk was planning on playing in an upcoming four-ball tournament in Hollywood, Florida. Four-ball is a match between two teams with two players. Each golfer plays her own ball, but each team gets the score of the lowest-scoring team member. "I need a partner for that international four-ball," she told Kirk, "and you might as well win a tournament." Kirk ignored a momentary pang of resentment at Babe's catty remark and quickly accepted the invitation. This was the great Babe Diedrichsen recruiting her as a partner, after all. When that happened, Kirk knew, you checked your ego at the door. 2 weeks later, they met in Hollywood. On the driving range prior to the first round, Babe noticed that Kirk was hitting errant shots and shaking with nerves. "What's wrong with you?" Babe asked. "Oh, Babe, you've won all these tournaments, every one in Florida, and now I'm worried that it'll be my fault if you lose." "Look, Peggy, I can beat any two of them without you. I'll let you know if I need you, so let's go." In one round, Kirk shot an ugly 7 on the first hole. As they walked to the second tee, Babe put her arm around her and said, "Now, Peggy, why don't you see if you can just par from here on in?" The remark boosted Kirk's confidence, and she ended up shooting a 74 for the round. Babe and Kirk didn't win the tournament, but it was not Kirk's fault. Babe was off her game. When the season ended, the Associated Press voted Babe the Female Athlete of the Year, an honor she had first earned 13 years earlier. Babe later described herself as getting a special charge out of that 1945 award because it had been so many years since I'd had this recognition. Award in hand, Babe had big plans for 1946. A full post-war schedule of 20 amateur tournaments beckoned. "I want to establish the longest winning streak in the history of women's golf," Babe told a reporter for Coronet magazine in 1946. But a single goal, even one as ambitious as a winning streak, was never enough for Babe. She also wanted to win that year's U.S. Women's Amateur. Babe began slowly, losing the Women's Western Amateur in the semifinals in June. But the following month, in her adopted hometown of Denver, she defeated Polly Riley, a chunky, gum-chewing 20-year-old, for the Women's Trans-Mississippi Championship. In the 36-hole final, Riley stubbed a 2-foot putt, losing a pivotal back 9 hole by a stroke.
"You sure should have snagged that one, Polly," Babe told her.
Riley was all confidence, but that remark rattled her, and she lost by 6 holes. Babe won her next two tournaments, the Broadmoor Ladies Invitation, and the All-American Open Championship for Women at George S. May's Tam O'Shanter Country Club in Niles, Illinois. At this point, Babe and George claimed that she was taking a 3-win streak into the U.S. Women's Amateur. But in fact, Babe had lost her match in the first professional U.S. Women's Open in Spokane, Washington on August 26th. The women on the tour grumbled
The babe had conveniently forgotten about that one in order to keep her streak alive. The U.S. Women's Amateur was arguably the marquee event on the women's golfing calendar. This was the first national amateur championship of Babe's career, held that year in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at Southern Hills Country Club, an extremely long course that swallowed up players with little power off the tee. "I always liked that kind," Babe later said. Because one of her goals was to claim the national, Babe felt the pressure. After all, she had wanted this prize for more than 13 years, she explained. "From the time I first took up golf seriously, it would be a terrible thing to go through an entire golf career without ever winning the national." Babe breezed through the 36-hole qualifying round, finishing third, and she easily defeated her competitors, Peggy Kirk, Maureen Orcutt, and Helen Seigel, to qualify for the final against Clara Callender, who had recently married and was now known as Clara Sherman. Babe and Sherman were even after six holes, but then Babe took over. "I was hot, she wasn't," Babe recalled. By the time they broke for lunch after 18 holes, Babe was ahead by five holes, and she wouldn't look back. On the par 4 eighth, Babe made an eagle. Her 130-yard second shot, with a 9-iron, went into the cup for a 2. And by the ninth hole in the afternoon session, the U.S. Women's Amateur belonged to Babe. Her winning margin of 11-9 was the second widest in the history of the championship. In some tournaments, you get lucky. The ball takes a fortunate bounce, hits a tree, and ricochets onto the fairway or even the green. And you get another break or two, or even three, that you don't really deserve. Babe said that she never liked winning that way. At the U.S. Women's Amateur, she didn't. It was one of the best rounds of her life. "I'm never really satisfied unless I can feel that I'm hitting the ball just right," she said. And during the national, she was. Babe kept winning. In October, she won the Women's Texas Open for the second time, defeating Betty Hicks 5-3. It was the last tournament of the season, and her glittering record ensured her second consecutive selection as the Associated Press Female Athlete of the Year. Babe drove home to Denver to spend some much-needed time with George. She was looking forward to recuperating, tending to her rose garden, and buying some furnishings for their home, the first full-fledged house we'd ever owned. Babe didn't just plan on taking the holidays off. She intended on taking the winter and spring off, too, skipping the slate of tournaments in Florida and elsewhere in the South. George was thinking about her streak. "Honey," he told her, "you've got something going here. You want to build that streak up into a record they'll never forget. There are some women's tournaments in Florida at the start of the winter. I think you should go down there." Babe didn't want to. She was bone tired and needed a long break from tournament golf. But George insisted. He was her coach, trainer, and manager after all, and he wanted her to play every tournament she could. The competition would be soft, he said, especially in some of the smaller Florida tournaments. She should not pass up a chance to extend her winning streak. Babe reluctantly acquiesced, but on one condition. George needed to join her. He agreed, but at the last minute backed out, citing a series of wrestling and boxing matches that he needed to promote in Denver. Babe and George drove to Pueblo, where they spent the night with George's mother and father. The next morning, George returned to Denver while Babe drove her car toward Florida. After 150 miles on the road, Babe turned around and went back home. "What are you doing here?" George asked. "The farther I got down the road, the more lonesome I got," Babe said. "I'm not going to go." During the romantic first year of their courtship, Babe had driven from her sister's house in Arizona back to Los Angeles and then on to San Francisco to be with George. He had appreciated the gesture then, but not now.
This was business. George insisted that she leave for Florida immediately.
Babe was heartbroken. She liked having George on tour with her because he was good company, and he helped her relax in the evenings by giving the best rubdowns. But following orders, she departed.
In late January, Babe began a long stretch of playing a tournament a week, all over Florida. Some of the courses were in sorry shape, so much so that the rules allowed the players to move a ball out of a bad lie on the fairway. Although galleries sometimes objected, it was accepted practice because the unwatered fairways were so chopped up. Babe's Florida tour began at the Tampa Women's Open. She moved south to the Helen Lee Doherty Women's Amateur at the Miami Country Club. The following week, she played the Florida Mixed Two-Ball Championship in Orlando, teaming up with Gerald G. Walker, the big league ball player. She won them all. Her legitimate winning streak was now 5 in a row, although Babe and George were claiming 8. Babe called George back in Denver.
"I'm tired of traveling around down here by myself," she told him. "I'm ready to come home."
"No, honey," he said. "Don't do that. You're in a hot streak. Stay with it."
Babe nearly lost her next two tournaments. In the Palm Beach Championship, Babe was trailing Gene Hopkins in the final round by 2 with 3 holes to play, but she managed to win every one of the last holes to win by a hole. In Hollywood, Florida, at the Women's International Four Ball, Babe teamed up again with Peggy Kirk. In the final against Gene Hopkins and Louise Suggs, the match was all square after 35 holes. It was nearly dark, but the officials allowed the players to tee off for the final par 4 hole, and a couple of them made their second shots. Then someone accused a fan of picking up one of the second shots from the rough and throwing it onto the green, but it was so dark that no one could be sure. Some people in the gallery shouted that the match should be suspended. Others insisted that they finish. The officials finally called off the match. The next day, Babe and Kirk won the 18-hole playoff, 4-2. That gave Babe 7 straight wins. Win number 8 was the South Atlantic Women's Amateur Championship in Ormond Beach, Florida. Win 9 was the Florida East Coast Women's Amateur Championship in St. Augustine. And win 10 was the Women's Title Holders Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, the sister tourney of the Masters. In Augusta, Babe trailed Dorothy Kirby by as many as 10 strokes, but roared back to win by 5 strokes, carding a 72-hole total of 304. Unlike the other tournaments, the title holders penalized players who moved a ball out of a bad spot.
"It's golf as golf should be played," Babe said.
Next came the North and South Women's Amateur in Pinehurst, North Carolina. George had finally joined Babe, who played against Louise Suggs and nearly had her streak snapped. On the par 3 17th hole in the final, Babe was ahead by 1 hole, but her tee shot landed at the base of a tree, making a swing at it impossible. Babe prepared to try a billiard-style trick shot by hitting the ball off the tree and hoping it would carom left onto the green. Reaching down quickly to brush away a clump of pine straw, she accidentally moved her ball, costing her a penalty stroke.
"I wound up with a 5, Babe said, while Louise came out of a bunker to get down in 4 and square the match.
George watched grimly from the gallery, puffing on a cigar as Babe called the penalty on herself. He felt certain that the penalty would cost her the tournament, ending her winning streak in the most unfortunate way imaginable. Babe and Suggs halved the first extra hole, but on the second hole, Babe sank a lengthy birdie putt to win. Babe and George returned home to mull over her next move.
"Honey," George said, "you want to go over to Scotland and play in the British Women's Amateur in June? You need something like that to top off your streak. The way Bobby Jones went over and played those British tournaments the year he made his Grand Slam."
An American woman had never won it, and it would be a great feat if Babe was the first. But Babe was dubious.
I won't go unless you go with me, she said.
Sure, honey, I'll go with you. I'll make it if I possibly can.
I know you, Babe said. You're giving me some more of that old con. You won't go. You'll never be able to get away for that long.
Babe sought the advice of Tommy Armour, the pro who had helped her straighten out her drives back in the early 1940s at Medina Country Club in Illinois. Armour, a Scotsman, said,
Mildred, you go. It doesn't matter who's in the tournament. This is the one you must win.
Armour's enthusiasm made up Babe's mind. George didn't join her, of course. She made preparations to travel on the Queen Elizabeth alone for the trip to Scotland, where she was determined to become the first American woman to win the 54-year-old British Women's Amateur Championship. Babe was growing accustomed to traveling alone. Hadn't she traveled to the Olympics in Los Angeles by herself, without any family to buck her up and cheer her on? That had turned out okay. But back then, of course, she'd had no husband. Now, Babe couldn't help but feel that aside from traveling alone, she was being abandoned. Chapter 17, The Highland Fling. Babe landed at Southampton, England on a scorching early June day, the hottest in more than half a century. She was ill-prepared for that kind of heat, and worse, she had overpacked. Several bulky pieces of luggage, two cameras, a knitting bag, even a fur coat. She lugged her belongings aboard the packed boat train bound for London. Because there were no empty seats, Babe stood in the aisle the entire way, as the sweat streamed down her back. In London, Babe tried to hail an empty taxicab to King's Cross Station, where she would catch the train for Edinburgh. But she had unknowingly cut off a large crowd of waiting travelers.
Lady, Babe was told, you have to wait in the queue.
Queue? What's a queue?
The locals explained that Babe needed to stand in line, along with everyone else, until her turn came. After 25 taxis came and went, Babe and several strangers packed themselves and their luggage into a taxi for the ride to London Central train station. At King's Cross, as Babe was unloading her baggage, the station gates were suddenly thrown shut.
What in the world is this? She asked a police officer. Why are they closing the gates?
The king and queen are coming, the officer said.
Workmen unpacked bouquets of flowers and unfurled a long red carpet up the steps of the train station. Babe watched as King George VI and Queen Elizabeth emerged from a black limousine. They waved quickly to their subjects before hurrying up the red carpet into the train station. Not long after they disappeared, Babe followed them, dragging her belongings up the carpet to catch her train.
Lady, you cannot walk on that carpet, a man in a uniform told her. You cannot go that way.
I'm sorry, Babe said, but I have to get my ticket. I have to catch that train to Edinburgh.
The man told Babe that she needed to use the King's Cross Annex, which was open to the public while the king and queen boarded the royal train, bound for one of their country estates up north. Clutching her first class ticket, Babe barely made her 1 p.m. train. Again, all the seats in the first class compartment were filled with passengers, many of them men in uniform.
Doesn't a first class ticket mean that I get a seat? Babe asked the conductor.
No, madam, first come, first served.
Once again, Babe was forced to stand in the aisle for the 10-hour journey. The train was hotter than ever, she recalled. The windows were open, we'd have suffocated otherwise, and soot from the engine was blowing in. There were black specks all over my face and hair. I was dripping all over. My curls had come down. I thought I was going to faint any minute. Babe wondered whether this trip would be worth it, and she silently cursed George and his relentless push for her to outdo herself. If the decision had been hers, she would have stayed home in Denver and tended to her roses. Babe's train rolled into Edinburgh after 11 o'clock p.m. She was exhausted. This was hardly the beginning she had envisioned, but at least she didn't have to stand in a taxi queue here. A hired car was waiting to take her directly to her hotel in Gallane, a small town outside the Scottish capital. From then on, she said, things couldn't have been nicer. Gallane is a majestic medieval village nestled on the southern shore of the Firth of Forth in East Lothian on Scotland's craggy East End. The village is only 18 miles up the road from Edinburgh, but to Babe, it felt 1,000 miles away from the civilized world. When Babe checked in at the North Berwick Inn, a grand old stone hotel and pub doing business since the 16th century, she was greeted by a desk clerk who declared himself a big fan. The next morning, in the dining room, she was asked what she'd like for breakfast.
Well, I'd like some bacon or ham and eggs and some fried potatoes and toast and coffee, she said. But I don't suppose I can get that here.
Post-war food rationing was still in effect in the United Kingdom.
Mrs. Aharius, a waiter said, we've got all that. The manager is keeping some chickens out there just for you.
The manager had purchased a large supply of bacon and ham from a nearby American boat just for Babe.
That's as nice a thing as I ever heard of, Babe said.
After an authentic American breakfast, Babe strolled out the hotel door and squinted into the faint Scottish sun, which was already high in the sky, where it would remain until past midnight. On the cobblestone streets, nearly everyone, men, women, boys, and girls, rode bicycles, with their pant legs tucked inside their socks so they didn't get tangled in the chain and spokes. Rather than renting a bike for her trip to the Gallane Golf Club, Babe decided to walk up West Lynx Road, bordered by brightly colored centuries-old homes. Behind ancient stone fences, most of the Scots recognized Babe.
Hello, Mrs. Aharius, they called. Just call me Babe, she replied.
She said the same to the newspaper reporters.
I wish you'd ask everybody just to call me Babe.
Perched above the coarse, jagged coast, the Gallane Golf Club is a chain of 3 golf courses carved into a grassed-over volcanic plug. The club's jewel is Gallane No. 1, the track that was hosting the 1947 British Women's Amateur Championship. Gallane No. 1 is a hilly links course that runs up Gallane Hill, where the seascape view is among the most spectacular in Scotland, then runs back down. Ferocious sea winds lash the course's undulating fairways and tall grasses. Joyce Wethered, the famed British golf champion, adored the first tee. The way of approach is down the village street, she said. One step straight off it, as it were, onto a village green, to tee up beneath the shade of plane trees, their brown leaves dry and crackling underfoot. The famous British golf writer Bernard Darwin proclaimed the Gallane Golf Club one of the most beautiful spots in the world. It was beautiful, and in Babe's mind, also intimidating, despite the fact that this craggy patch of land could be confused with a working sheep farm. A large flock enjoyed full run of the 3 courses, grazing on the fairways and greens. When players got too close, the animals ducked into a bunker or waded into the deep rough. On Sunday, the courses were closed, and families used the 54 fairways and greens to stroll, fly kites, eat picnic lunches, and read the newspaper. Inside the clubhouse, the men warned Babe to try to steer her ball clear of the winds. She assumed they meant the unpredictable sea gusts, but the winds was the locals' phrase for the hedge-like thickets of tall grass bordering on what passed for the fairways. The men also presented Babe with a hospitable perk, a gentleman clad in a well-pressed white coat and armed with a scooper. The man's assignment was to walk a few paces in front of Babe to pick up any sheep droppings on the greens. Along the shore, Babe spotted crews of former Polish soldiers removing large cement pillars roughly 5 feet thick and 8 feet above the ground. These pillars had been installed during the war along the coast to defend against invasion. The workmen were rushing to finish the last few pillars before the championship began. Babe was surprised to discover
that there were no practice greens or tees at Galen. They just practiced by playing around the course, she recalled. After dinner each evening, Babe played a round of 18 holes. She wanted to get accustomed to the course's layout, as well as to the size of the golf balls, which were slightly smaller than those in the United States. She happily discovered that her usually long drives carried even farther at Galen, because the June sun had still not adequately softened the ground hardened by a bitterly cold winter. The fairways were heavy enough to allow Babe's big drives to roll even farther, too. Each evening, George phoned from Denver to check in. Hi, honey, Babe said one evening. It's 11 o'clock at night here, and I just got in from playing around. Good Lord, George said. Now take it easy, will you? Like Colonel McCombs before him, George thought that Babe overtrained in the days leading up to her most challenging matches, burning valuable energy required for the real thing. On just her second night of practice, Babe lashed awkwardly at a ball buried in the tall, wet grass, pummeling the ground with her club and chipping a bone in her left thumb. The following morning, she visited a town doctor, who prescribed a painkiller and wrapped her thumb in an elastic bandage. Babe said nothing to the press or anyone else about her injury. I didn't want anybody to think I was trying to build up an advance alibi for myself, she explained years later. So I just wore a glove over it, and nobody noticed that there was anything the matter with my thumb. She was surprised to learn that her injury actually improved her accuracy. Her sore thumb made it impossible to swing as hard as usual, which kept her ball from veering off into the winds. Babe was then confronted with a trickier dilemma, her wardrobe. She had packed for summer weather, putting only a few light sweaters in her suitcase, including an orange cashmere sweater with angora in it. Despite the steamy start to her trip, the weather in Scotland had turned cold and damp. When the British newspapers revealed Babe's problem, Galen residents dropped off care packages containing heavy clothing. Then, in the Morning Post, dozens more packages arrived from all over the British Isles. Dubbed by the press, bundles for Babe, the packages were piled nearly as high as the ceiling in the inn's lobby. Babe opened a dozen packages and selected a smart-looking siren suit, the type of outfit worn by British air raid workers, and a pair of slightly faded, slate-blue corduroy slacks that kept her legs warm. Golf fans across Britain dubbed those corduroys Babe's Slocks. After she started winning, they called them her Lucky Slocks. On the first day of the tournament, Babe strolled from her inn to the first tee of Galen number 1, which is just off the main road that connects Edinburgh and North Berwick. The tee was surrounded by a fence of white posts with a top rail, which spectators leaned on to watch the players begin their rounds. Babe hurtled over the rail, a spectacle that amused the very small group of early morning spectators. I thought Scotland was golf country, Babe said to the club secretary. Where are all the people? They'll be here. 14 years earlier, in 1933, Helen Hicks, a 22-year-old amateur golfing sensation, was asked this question by a reporter. What chance has an American girl of winning the British title? And how soon? I think in a very few years, said Hicks, fresh off winning the U.S. Women's Amateur Championship in Buffalo. It amuses me, all this hooey about a championship abroad. We all go over there with an alibi, ready-made. The weather. You'd think we never had wind or rain here. Hicks was also asked this question. Could Babe Diedrichsen, in your opinion, ever become a champion golfer at her age? I don't think so, Hicks said. Golf is different from anything she ever tackled, a fact which she'll learn if she ever attempts to play in a championship. In track competition, it's all over in a jiffy. Golf takes 6 days, long days with nights in between, and a 36-hole final. 14 years later, despite Hicks' optimism, an American had still not won the British Amateur Golf Championship, the premier women's golf championship in all of Europe,
which had begun in 1893. In 1929, one of the greatest American golfers, Glenna Collette Vare, had come closest to winning, but lost in heartbreaking fashion to Joyce Wetherid. Ahead by 5 holes with just 7 to play, Vare's collapse was so complete that the loss ranked as the most devastating of her career. She made the final the following year, but lost again. Babe knew that her legacy as one of the game's greats was likely on the line at Galena. Bobby Jones had won the Open Championship 3 times and the Amateur Championship once. And all of the era's finest American men players, Walter Hagen, Sam Snead, and Gene Sarazen, all players Babe admired and had played with, had won the biggest championship on British soil. Babe was one of 99 amateurs entered in the championship and one of only 3 Americans. The event attracted the finest women golfers from the United Kingdom and Ireland. 12 were members of the Curtis Cup team. A biannual match started in 1932. The Curtis Cup pitted a team of amateur golfers from the United States against a team from Great Britain and Ireland. The match had been postponed during World War II, but would resume in 1948 at the Royal Birkdale Golf Club in Southport, England. Each day of the Women's Amateur Golf Championship consisted of 2 matches, an 18-hole round in the morning and another 18-hole round against a new opponent after lunch. There was no qualifying round, and the name of your first opponent was pulled from a hat. Babe's first opponent was a woman named Helen Nemo, a member of the Galena Golf Club. Sure enough, the people arrived just in time to see Babe and Nemo tee off, and the large gallery followed them avidly around the course. This was the quietest, most well-behaved gallery that Babe had ever seen. They didn't yell or holler or cheer or even applaud. "Well played," a few would say, or "fine shot." Their manners were unnerving. Babe didn't hear any applause until she clinched the first round on the 12th hole. Then the gallery clapped as if the tournament were a piano recital. Babe depended on the crowd's enthusiasm. She fed off it and felt deprived of fuel without it. During the lunch break, Babe pulled aside the tournament marshal, Helen Holm, a former British women's amateur champion. "I wish these people would just holler and enjoy themselves the way the crowds do back home," Babe told her. Holm described the long-standing Scottish tradition of restrained appreciation for good play. Gallery members tried not to distract the players with unnecessary noise. That way, every player had an equal chance to concentrate on making her shots. Babe had another problem. Galena Golf Club had assigned her an 80-year-old caddy, who insisted on advising her on every shot, club selection, wind speed, everything. On one hole, Babe wanted to use a wedge, but the caddy handed her a 3-iron. "Would you please leave the clubs in the bag and let me pick them out?" Babe asked. "Madame," the caddy said, "the wind is against you. You should take this 3-iron and run the ball up there." "I don't play 2- and 3-iron pitches on little short shots," Babe said. "I'm used to hitting the ball up in the air." She used the wedge. A story in the British press claimed that Babe had insisted on a new, younger caddy, and the 80-year-old was replaced with a 75-year-old. On the 16th hole that first afternoon, Babe won her match against Janet Shepherd, a Midlands amateur with a strong tournament record. Babe's long drives astonished the crowd. "It seems cruel to send our girls out against a game like that," one Scot said. As she sometimes did in the United States, Babe decided to play the bye holes, the remaining 2 holes. They didn't count, but Babe saw it as a chance to entertain the large gallery, a kind of encore on the greens. If this stunt didn't loosen up the crowd, nothing would. When she hit the ball, the match crackled like a small cannon. The crowd laughed and cheered. With her ball stuck in a deep sand trap, Babe balanced a 2nd ball on top of the 1st, swung an iron gently into both. The club motion made 1 ball pop in front of Babe. She caught it in her shirt pocket,
while the second ball hit the green and rolled into the hole. The crowd roared. They had never seen such a crazy trick. Then on the 18th green, Babe bent over and putted the ball backward between her legs. It went into the hole. She remained on the fringe of the 18th green for an hour, signing autographs and shaking hands. The next day, a sign was posted on the clubhouse wall. Please do not play the bye holes. The event's administrators did not appreciate their storied championship being turned into an impromptu circus. In fact, several elderly Ghislaine Golf Club members complained to Helen Holm about Babe's antics, saying her uncouth style had deeply embarrassed them and the club. Holm just shook her head. "You are speaking of the finest woman golfer that has ever been seen here," she told them. The Scottish fans agreed with that assessment. The next day, Babe's gallery had grown in size and sound. That morning, an older woman with a thick Scottish accent approached Babe with an urgent message. "Did you know that there is a jinx against American women in this tournament? Why, your greatest players have come here, women like Glenna Collette and Virginia Van Wee, and they've never been able to win." Babe was taken aback, but the woman went on. "Aren't you worried about the jinx?" "I didn't come over here to lose," Babe replied and walked away. She had no idea who the woman was, but Babe assumed she might have been a former player. The woman likely credited the jinx with knocking out the other two American women, Helen Seigel and Ruth Woodward, in the early rounds of the championship. Their early exits meant that Babe was the only player left with a chance to become the first American to win the British Women's Amateur. Babe defeated her next three opponents, Mrs. Val Redden, a former Irish champion, Mrs. Cosmo Falconer, a Scottish champion, and Frances Stevens, a slender teenager from Lancashire, who kept pace with Babe for 12 holes before losing 3-2. Several times in the clubhouse and on the fairway, the odd Scottish woman warned Babe, "Don't forget about the jinx." In the semifinals, Babe faced the Scottish champion, Jean Donald, the daughter of a beloved local doctor. This was a highly anticipated, all-champion 18-hole match that attracted more than 8,000 people to Ghislaine, a larger crowd than had attended the men's amateur championship at Carnoustie in late May. Donald three-putted on the first hole, then Babe strung together three straight birdies. The match was never close. When Babe walked off the 12th green, up by six with just six holes to play, she reapplied her lipstick. A writer later said that Babe was so sure she'd win the match on the next hole that she put on the lipstick to freshen up for the photographers. Babe did win on the next hole, and with a platoon of photographers crowding around, she and Donald danced the Highland Fling, one of the oldest Highland dances, performed by soldiers to celebrate victory in battle. Babe called her opponent a real good sport. In the final 36-hole match, Babe would face Jacqueline Gordon, a Middlesex woman whose consistent play all week had vindicated her selection for the 1948 Curtis Cup team. The night before the final, Babe struggled to fall asleep. She kept worrying and wondering about the jinx. Her room was uncomfortably cold, and the heater wasn't really helping. She had pulled down the blackout shades to blot out the late evening sunlight. Finally, she got out of bed and ordered a pot of tea. When the desk clerk brought it, Babe admitted to him that she was having trouble sleeping because she was worrying about the local woman's warnings about the American jinx. "Mrs. Aharius, don't take any notice of her," the clerk said. "Everybody here wants you to win." Several hours later, Babe woke up in a much better mood. It was a beautiful, warm morning, the nicest of her stay in Scotland. She dug out some of her warm weather clothes, pink and white checked Bermuda shorts and a light sweater. She wore white golf shoes, a matching white visor, and a white glove to hide the bandage wrapped on her left hand. "Oh, I was a doll that morning," she later said.
The first tee was surrounded by an enormous crowd that had come to witness the first drives by Babe and Gordon. When Babe spotted a Union Jack flag, she stood at attention and saluted it. The crowd applauded. She then searched for an American flag. Someone pointed to one stretched on the roof of the clubhouse. Babe turned toward the Stars and Stripes, got down on her knees, and bowed three times. The crowd loved it. The press had proclaimed Babe the prohibitive favorite, and most wagers at the bookies were placed on Babe. But if Gordon was intimidated by the press or the oddsmakers, she did not show it during the morning round. After 11 holes, Gordon led Babe by 2. And by the end of the morning session, they were tied. Each had shot a 75. This was shaping up to be Babe's toughest challenge. She tried not to think about the jinx. "Babe, go get your slocks on," the Scottish fans told Babe as she walked off the 18th green. "Go get your slocks on." The way the fans saw it, Babe needed her lucky slocks if she had any chance of defeating her pesky challenger. By lunchtime, the weather had suddenly turned cold, and Babe walked quickly back to her hotel. Her white golf shoes had also given her some trouble. The soles were cracked in a few places and needed to be repaired. After lunch and a brief nap, she changed back into her siren suit and slate-blue corduroy slacks. She later said it wasn't because of any superstition. "I was just cold," she insisted. Back at the club, Babe carried her cracked golf shoes to the shoemaker's shop. A sign in the window said, "Sorry, closed. Gone to see the Babe." When someone informed the lady shoemaker that Babe required her immediate attention, she returned quickly and fixed Babe's shoes in time for the afternoon round. On the first hole, Babe broke the deadlock by making a par to Gordon's bogey. On the par 5 second hole, Babe made an eagle 3. That's all it took. She knew she was in charge. On another hole, Babe hit a monstrous 260-yard drive, leaving herself a short wedge shot to the green. As she walked up the fairway, she fell in step behind 2 elderly men wearing kilts. "I've watched Walter Hagen and Bobby Jones and Gene Sedison and all those Americans who've played here," one told the other, "and none of them could hit the ball better than this girl can." Babe smiled. She caught up with the men, draping her arms across their shoulders. "How'd you boys like to see me knock this little wedge shot right into the cup?" she asked. "Ah ha ha," they said, laughing. "That would be fine." And Babe almost did it. Her ball stopped on the lip of the cup. The 2 old Scotsmen watched, speechless. Babe won the match by 5 holes with 4 left to play. The crowd stood and applauded her for what seemed to be 15 minutes. "The pants did it," she said on the 14th green, laughing. Then she dramatically removed the glove from her left hand, showing the reporters her bandaged thumb. "It caused something of a sensation," she recalled. Babe danced another Highland fling and hurtled over a brown brick wall near the clubhouse. When she was presented with the amateur trophy, the Big Cup, Babe called it, she sang a Highland song. The fans just loved it. A reporter asked Babe to reveal the secret of her success. "I just loosen my girdle and let the ball have it," she said. This line was published in all the newspapers in Britain and beamed all over the world. Some commentators in the United Kingdom thought the quip, one of Babe's most famous, was unbecoming for the British women's amateur champion. Babe later insisted that she had not uttered those words in Scotland, but had first said them at the Celebrities Championship in Washington, D.C., the previous month. Despite that one false note, she had become the darling of the British press. "Surely no woman golfer has accomplished in a championship what Mrs. Zaharias has achieved in this one," said the Manchester Guardian. "She is a crushing and heartbreaking opponent." A London newspaper declared, "We have not seen a fairway phantom like her, not in 47 years. What a babe." At the ceremony for the presentation of the handsome silver trophy, Babe wore a blue gabardine dress and white and blue shoes. She said she looked forward to returning back home to George. This is the first time in 9 years that I have been separated from him for so long. Before going home, however, Babe indulged in a 2-week victory lap around a few of Scotland's finest golf courses. First, she played the old course at St. Andrews. Spectators were forbidden to follow her, to allow her privacy. But when Babe spotted more than 1,000 people penned in a long distance away, she waved them over and yelled, "Come on!" The crowd followed her for all 18 holes. On the 18th green, Babe told the gallery how much it meant for her to play the storied course, even though she said later, "The course gave me an awful letdown." This was golf's birthplace, and Babe ruminated over all the legends of the game who had blazed the path across the old course. "And I thought of all the great matches that had been decided on that course," she recalled, "and the hearts that had been broken there." On a foggy day at Muirfield, Babe shot a 71, her best score in Scotland. Afterward, she was invited for tea inside the all-male clubhouse. She also played Glen Eagles at Tommy Armour's club, Lothianburn, in front of a raucous throng of 3,000 fans. In Edinburgh, she spent her final evening in Scotland as the guest of the Ladies' Golf Union. At the train station, fans serenaded Babe on the platform, singing Auld Lang Syne. "I'd already been away from George longer than I ever had been since we got married," Babe recalled. "I wanted to get back home." On the London-bound train, she had a private compartment filled with flowers. Her return trip to Southampton on the boat train was also quite different from her first trip. Babe didn't have to wait in any line, and a porter tended to her luggage. She even had a seat. As the Queen Elizabeth approached New York, a tugboat carrying 71 reporters, photographers, and newsreel cameramen met the big ship. As Babe was standing on the rail, she spotted a big guy with a white shirt aboard the tug. "That's George," she said, then shoved two fingers into her mouth and whistled. At the same moment, the Queen Elizabeth blasted its horn. "Hey, George, here I am," she hollered. George yelled, "Honey, I could hear your whistle above the Queen Elizabeth's." Babe gave it right back to him. When a rope ladder was dropped to allow the members of the press to climb aboard the Queen Elizabeth, George was the first to climb up. When the big ship listed at the same time, Babe said, "Hey, honey, watch out. You're going to turn the Queen Elizabeth over." Aboard the ship, Babe, true to form, answered more than 2 hours' worth of questions. She plopped a blue Glengarry hat atop George's head and taught him the Highland fling. Then she showed the reporters the trophy, bearing the inscription, "Ladies Amateur Golf Club Challenge Cup, subscribed for by the Ladies Golf Union, 1893. It bore the names of all the winners since 1893, and for the first time, it would spend a year in the United States. "Seeing George again," Babe said, "gave me a greater thrill than I got when I won the championship." George vowed never to be apart from Babe for that long again.
"You can't imagine how I felt while the Babe was over there playing those matches," he told reporters. "I kept the transatlantic wires busy enough to pay my fare twice across and back."
In Manhattan, Babe was suddenly in the highest demand of her career. She fielded a flood of offers. George and Babe met with Fred Corcoran, the now legendary promotional director of the PGA, who offered to represent Babe if she decided to turn pro. Corcoran represented the top stars of golf and baseball, including Sam Snead and Ted Williams. Corcoran met George for the first time that day. He asked him what type of contract he wanted Babe to sign if she decided to turn professional.
"You and Babe work everything out," George replied.
Babe and George found time to see their old friend, Grantland Rice. Although he was suffering from pneumonia, Rice insisted that he visit them in their hotel room for an interview for his column.
"I spent a short half hour at their hotel, quietly celebrating with Babe and George Zaharias, two wonderful kids,"
who I feel constitute an unusually warm and wonderful American love story. Rice wrote, at last it was time to return home to Denver, where 50,000 people attended the city's parade honoring Babe. Each sport Babe had played was represented by a float. She stood on the last one, waving and smiling, surrounded by a carpet of red roses. At City Hall, Mayor Quig Newton presented her with an oversized golden key to the city. It was 16 feet tall and weighed 250 pounds. Asked how she planned to transport the key home, Babe said, George will carry it. Part 3. Again. Chapter 18. A Piece of Work. Before the lunchtime rush on August 14, 1947, a few dozen New York reporters congregated inside Toots Shores Restaurant on 51st Street to hear Babe announce that she was abandoning the amateur sporting life again. As George saw it, his wife was seizing the opportunity to go out on top. Wasn't Babe riding a double-digit amateur tournament winning streak? After she won the Broadmoor Ladies Invitation in Colorado Springs after returning from Scotland, the press was reporting her winning streak as 17 in a row, not counting her Spokane defeat. But even at 14 consecutive victories, Babe's streak was unmatched by any male or female golfer in American history. The closest anyone had come was Byron Nelson, who won 11 straight PGA Tour events in 1945. A fellow Texan, Nelson said, in Texas, we call someone like Babe Zaharias a piece of work. But brash as she could be at times, she sure could back it up. There was precedent for joining the professional ranks, too. Patty Berg had turned pro in 1940 at the age of 22 and had a contract with Wilson Sporting Goods. Betty Jameson and a handful of others also had made deals with corporate sponsors and played exclusively in each year's half-dozen professional tournaments. Without those endorsements, some of the women could not have survived simply by playing golf. But Babe wasn't sure that turning pro now was the wisest choice. At the start of the decade, she had struggled to recapture her amateur status, and the memory of that three-year USGA-imposed penance was still fresh. How much more money did George and Babe need, especially considering she no longer had parents she needed to support? How many T-bone steaks could they eat? But George and Fred Corcoran said that she really didn't have a choice. There was too much cash to be made. The most tantalizing offer Babe received was from a Hollywood filmmaker, who told George by phone that he was willing to pay Babe $300,000 for a series of 10 movie shorts about sports. There was talk of a book and a new golf exhibition tour. Several of America's finest country clubs in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles clamored to sign Babe as their resident club pro. Sporting goods companies, women's clothing manufacturers, and watchmakers jostled for the privilege to use Babe's name to sell their products. Babe made her decision official in a telegram to Charles W. Littlefield, president of the USGA. I wish to advise that after considerable deliberation, I have decided to accept a motion picture offer. Therefore, I will be unable to defend my title in Detroit in September. I wish to express at this time my sincerest thanks to you and the officials of the United States Golf Association for the many courtesies and considerations extended to me. But things weren't that simple. At Toots Shores, a reporter asked Babe the obvious question, where are you going to play golf? Wasn't the point of becoming an amateur having 24 tournaments to play every year? Well, I'm going to enter the U.S. Open Championship for men, she replied. Her impromptu response stunned George and Corcoran, who had no idea that she was contemplating playing in America's Men's Open Championship. The reporters dashed out of the restaurant to hustle the story onto the wires. In a matter of days, the USGA passed a rule specifically prohibiting women, or more precisely, Babe, from competing for its top prize. As the championship has always been intended to be for men, The eligibility rules have been rephrased to confirm that condition, the USGA said in a statement. Thus, the USGA has declined an informal entry submitted on behalf of Mrs. George Zaharias. That rule has since been changed, and women are now allowed to play in all USGA championships. No matter, Babe's re-entry as a professional had captured all the headlines. Besides, she later said, I don't suppose I'd have finished around the top if they had let me in there, but I don't think I'd have been at the bottom either. I wouldn't have disgraced myself. Babe tried to justify her decision to abandon the amateur ranks by framing it as a desire to give back to the game that had made her a worldwide star. Within days, however, the proposed $300,000 movie deal fell through. At least that's what Babe and George told reporters. Pete Martin, the Saturday Evening Post writer, was convinced that no such offer had ever existed. He asked Babe to identify the film studio, but she refused. So Martin asked Corcoran, who said that George had been in discussions with Spiros Skouras, the president of 20th Century Fox. But Skouras told Martin that negotiations were still in a highly tentative status, so tentative that no figure for the Babe's services had been set. Martin was withering in his assessment of Babe's hype, writing that the $300,000 offer, which had been widely reported, may turn out to be more fabulous than any of the fables that have ever sprung up about the Babe. He went on to declare that no athlete had ever claimed to have been offered such a colossal sum to turn professional. The deceit did minimal damage to Babe and George's credibility. After she ended up making 3 sports-related movie shorts for Columbia Pictures for far more modest pay, many fans assumed she had been paid the preposterous sum that had been reported. Corcoran had assumed a big chunk of George's management of his wife's activities. Yet could he, one of the nation's leading sports agents, and George, who owned one of the sports world's biggest egos, co-manage Babe? Was there enough of Babe to go around? Nothing about this shared management arrangement was going to be easy or simple. In the beginning, Corcoran attempted to be extremely deferential to George, checking in with him for advice before doing anything. At the same time, George continued to book events for Babe, but Corcoran quickly realized that George would accept almost any sum in exchange for Babe's appearances, a habit that ran counter to Corcoran's own booking strategy. Corcoran explained to George that it was not in Babe's best interest if some clients discovered there were varying rates being paid for her appearances. George didn't like the comeuppance and sulked, feeling as if he was being edged out of the aspect of being Babe's husband that he enjoyed the most. The first thing Corcoran did was book Babe for several non-golfing exhibitions. Babe was paid $500 for pre-game baseball performances in parks all over the country, including Yankee Stadium, Wrigley Field, and spring training venues in Florida. She was on the field no more than 30 minutes, taking a few cuts during batting practice and hitting golf balls with her pitching wedge from home plate into the outfield. She wanted to try to smash the ball out of the park, but the owners refused, worried that she might hurt a fan. One night, at Detroit's Briggs Stadium, Tigers general manager Billy Evans tried to slash Babe's fee from $500 to $450. He told Corcoran that the stadium was already sold out because the Tigers were playing the Red Sox, and the fans wanted to see Ted Williams, not Babe Diedrichson. When Corcoran refused to lower the fee, Evans finally agreed to pay it. That night, a steady rain delayed the start of the game. When Babe emerged from the dugout to do her act on the parts of the field not covered by the tarp, the crowd gave her a standing ovation. The game ended up being postponed, but Babe was on the rain-slicked field for an hour. She had given the fans their money's worth, Corcoran said. At Yankee Stadium, a big pregame crowd watched Babe take the mound and throw a few pitches of batting practice. She beckoned Joe DiMaggio to the plate, but he refused and disappeared into the dugout. So Babe walked over and said, "Come on, Joe." He still refused, until Babe went into the dugout and grabbed his arm and a bat.
Babe hit DiMaggio in the ribs with a pitch, though he wasn't hurt. DiMaggio smashed a few of her pitches, then finally took a big pantomime swing and missed. Without a word, he sat back down. Although many writers have reported that Babe struck out DiMaggio, his third strike was a gift to Babe and the fans. At a Sarasota, Florida ballpark during spring training, Babe and Ted Williams faced off in a golf driving contest. Williams outdrove Babe, but not by the distance some fans had expected. When Williams dribbled one ball off the tee, Babe shouted, "Better run those grounders out, Ted. There may be an overthrow." Corcoran also signed Babe to endorse an array of products, from cigarettes and clothes to watches and car batteries. She was in such high demand that companies that produced similar products hired her, an odd arrangement that is almost never seen today. For example, Babe signed an $8,000 a year lifetime contract with Wilson Sporting Goods, which began manufacturing Babe Zaharia's golf clubs. She simultaneously re-signed with P. Goldsmith's Sons, another sporting goods company, which promised its dealers in a sales brochure, "Babe Diedrichsen Coordinated Golf Equipment will establish a new record in sales for you." Goldsmith also promised, "The name Babe Diedrichsen on a golf ball and a golf club will guarantee its saleability." Babe gave advice to Serban, a dress manufacturer, on the design of a golf dress and a blouse with buttons on the sleeves that accommodated a wider swing. "Sensible sports shirts for gals who want comfort with grooming," Babe called it. At the same time, for $10,000 a year, Babe agreed to wear weather-vane sports clothes. Like the sporting goods companies, the two rival clothing manufacturers did not mind sharing Babe. Suddenly, she was that ubiquitous. In a widely published print advertisement for Timex watches, Babe was pictured methodically driving a golf ball in one picture and happily washing dishes in another. "Housekeeping and golf, I love them both," she said. She endorsed cigarettes. Babe was a pack-a-day smoker, although this endorsement was the public's first hint of that fact, and even leased her name to the maker of the Presto Light high-level battery. Corcoran brokered a book deal with A.S. Barnes, a New York publisher. In the 125-page illustrated book titled Championship Golf, Babe, identified on the cover as Mildred Diedrichsen Zaharias, offers advice on every aspect of the game, from tips on grips and putting techniques to advice on practice and concentration. In the close-up photographs shot at Leawood Golf Club in East Chester, New York, Babe demonstrates her golfing techniques while appearing to be dressed for a formal dinner. She is wearing a dress with button sleeves and a chunky bracelet, and her fingernails are painted red. She dedicated the book to George, Stanley Curtis, Tommy Armour, the USGA, the PGA, and the sports writers and the many other friends I have made as a golfer. In the introduction, she recounts her record-setting track and field career, her time playing big-time basketball, and a fling at many other sports, but when that golf bug hit me, it was fatal. I've never recovered and hope I never will. I expect to play golf until I'm 90, even longer if anybody figures out a way to swing a club from a rocking chair. The how-to portion of the book is dry. Question: why do you and most other leading players grip your putter differently from your other clubs? Answer: no two grips seem to be quite alike in putting. Each player has one that is all his own. The important point in putting is to be comfortable and relaxed. Any grip that you find by experience to be effective and that leaves you comfortable and relaxed is a sound grip. Despite receiving mixed reviews, Championship Golf sold moderately well. Fresh off that success, Babe signed a contract to write a nationally syndicated newspaper column for the McNaught Syndicate. Titled The Babe Says, the column would consist of golf tips to be ghostwritten by Betty Hicks, a published writer. George hated the first three drafts, however, saying that Hicks' writing didn't sound like Babe. The column was killed before even one was published.
Soon, Corcoran was booking so many baseball and golf exhibitions for Babe that in a single month, she took 17 plane rides. George always bragged that no amount of physical exertion could slow down Babe, but now she was feeling exhausted, irritable, and resentful. She was out crisscrossing the country while George was home in Denver and Corcoran was in his office in New York. The two men were competing against each other to fill her calendar and, not incidentally, also to outdo each other. The result? Babe was living out of a suitcase. Mildred wouldn't turn anybody down, her brother Lewis said. She was on the move. We kept telling her and her husband, too, that she was overdoing it and that no human could hold up under that much stress and strain. It was inevitable that the hyperkinetic pace would catch up with Babe on the golf course. At the Women's Texas Open in Fort Worth that October, she lost in the quarterfinals to a little-known amateur named Betty Mims White. The stunning upset ended Babe's winning streak. Babe pinned all the blame on the frenzied pace prescribed by her handlers. I honestly believe that if I had squeaked through, I'd have gone on and stretched my winning streak to 25 or 30 tournaments, she later said. For a while after that loss, a little of my incentive was gone. I didn't have quite so much to work for now that my string was broken. Babe's audaciousness was, of course, typical. It was hard enough to win 14 tournaments in a row, but 25 or 30? Even as she lost a little incentive, Babe wasn't going to lose her determination to get back on the winning track. In her next tournament, the Hardscrabble Women's Invitational in Fort Smith, Arkansas, Babe demolished the field, shooting a 72-hole score of 293, a record low score for women in tournament stroke play. At the end of 1947, Babe was selected the Associated Press Female Athlete of the Year for the third consecutive year.